and so we can.
All right, thanks, Katya. So I just arrived in Santa Barbara this week. Hi, it's great to be here. I come from Hawaii, which is a place with slightly warmer beaches. Katya is my office mate, and she has roped me into giving this talk, which is basically a recycled colloquium. So if there's anything where you're like, oh, actually tell me more about this other thing, or like, don't tell me about that, just let me know, and we will proceed accordingly. Okay, so let's see. I'm a Parent Postdoctoral Fellow at the IFA. I just finished my first year there. It's great, and I'm really happy to be here. Okay. So I think about exoplanet systems as laboratories by which we can test planet formation.
Yeah, we had some issues with the clickers. Oh, it might be that you need to be quite close to the...
I know why.
That you might
this
as well just
this would be them. This would be why, actually.
Oh, okay.
That's how Bluetooth works. Okay, so there are a few different questions that we're going to answer in this talk. So things I'm interested in are, what are the common sizes and orbits of planets? What are the interior compositions of small planets? And recently, my big thing that I'm into is, how can we use multi-planet systems in particular to study planet formation? Okay, so we all know about Kepler. Kepler was great. The prime mission of Kepler was designed to study the statistics of exoplanets and was capable of finding Earth-sized planets in Earth-like orbits. So, of course, from Kepler, some of our transiting planets are really remarkable. This is Kepler-10, which, of course, has two small planets. So just to remind you what transit photometry looks like for those of you who look at, like, stars and stuff, right? Here's the detrended photometry of the star. And we can zoom in on this region here. You can see it's quite flat. But then there's this rain from the transits of a planet that are marked by the cyan line. And then within this region, we can also see that the red lines are denoting transits of a much shorter period planet. So when we
face... Can you go back?
Yeah.
There's something bad happening around 207 in the bottom panel.
No, that's just a transit of this one. That's not bad.
Okay, why
it's the
so
other
much
planet.
Than the others? Oh, okay, I see, yes.
Yeah, multi-planet systems. All right, so here the planets are phase folded, so you can see the relative, the drop in intensity from these transits is quite small, just a couple hundred parts per million for that one, and a bit more for that one. So what we get from these periods and transit depths is the size of the planet and the orbital period of the planet. And of course, here's the most recent published haul from Kepler. This is the DR25 release. So you can see there's a lot of planets, transiting planets, between the size of Earth and Neptune and with orbital periods of less than 100 days. So we've learned from Kepler that small planets close to their stars are super common. But we'd really like to know, what are those small planets made of, right? So in our own solar system, we have Earth and we have Neptune, but we have no examples of planets with intermediate sizes. So how do we measure the masses of planets? Well, with radial velocities. This is Mauna Kea, as seen from the International Space Station. And we can zoom in and see this lovely little ring of observatories. And I love them all, but my favorite of the observatories is the Keck Observatory. And Keck 1, which is right here, is capable of detecting planets and measuring their masses through radial velocities. So as the star and planet orbit the barycenter of the system, the star comes toward the telescope and the light is blue shifted. And then when the star goes away from the telescope, the light is redshifted. And if you have multiple planets, these effects all add linearly. So what we want to do is record the stellar spectrum to measure these redshifts and blue shifts. And to do that, we use the high-resolution Echelle spectrograph called HiRes. So the light comes in from the telescope, hits our Echelle grating and cross disperser, and is recorded on a CCD. Here is an example of a high-resolution spectrum from an Echelle spectrograph. So this is of the sun, you can see the sodium D lines. Here's H-alpha. And what we're looking for is tiny, tiny changes in the shifts of all of these lines. So what we do is, right, each night we're measuring the velocity based on the positions of those lines and can map out the radial velocity over time. So it takes many, many measurements to get the mass of a planet. Yeah, Jim?
Which of those lines is most useful for actually getting the RVs?
I think the iron lines are probably the best. For instance, sodium D is bad because of sky contamination. H-alpha is terrible because of activity. But they look great in this image, right? Like, that's why I point them out, is I don't know by name, like, what are some of these smaller, finer lines.
Probably
most anything
of the lines
that's...
would be iron.
Okay.
By definition.
Do you mean by element or by wavelength?
I mean, if you're trying to get RVs from a bunch of these spectra, where is that information actually encoded?
Yeah.
Which lines are really dominating the measurements?
It's not the hydrogen lines. Anything that like is saturated in the curve of growth is going to be bad for centroiding. So probably anything that's like a super beautiful dark line here is not great for RVs.
It also depends if you're using iodine, you're at 500 to 600, and there's lots of iodine.
Yeah.
But if you're not using iodine, like HARPS, you're going to be more in the blue than the other things.
That's right.
Well.
Yeah, and for on high res, we use the iodine region, so we're not actually H alpha is not in that region, so we're pretty much in. In this region here, the green part. Okay. Okay, so moving on. So this toy model is for Jupiter, which has a semi-amplitude of 12 meters per second that it induces on the sun. At the moment, the state-of-the-art precision RVs from a high res are 3 meters per second or so. So if we think about Earth, well, it has about 1/300th of Jupiter's mass and is at 1/5 of the orbital distance. So you lose a factor of 300 in the amplitude, but get you get root 5 back. So that turns out to be a stellar velocity amplitude of 10 centimeters per second. So the next generation RV instruments that we are currently building and commissioning are capable of about 20 or 30 centimeters per second. So we are pushing closer and closer to measuring the masses of Earth-like objects. Okay, so to go back to our question, what are the compositions of Kepler's small planets? We can take the mass of the planet as determined through radial velocities, divided by the volume as determined from the transit to calculate density. So let's look at Kepler 10b. This is the one I just showed you in transit. This is actually Kepler's first rocky planet. We can look at the velocity versus orbital phase here. And there are individual measurements, and then the bind measurements are shown here. This is from Battaglia et al. 2011. And from the RVs, we get a mass and a density for this planet that are consistent with a rocky composition. Okay, so that's just one example, but we'd really like to know for the majority of these small planets, what are their densities? So a few years ago, I led a study in which we looked at the densities of 65 small exoplanets and found a transition in planet composition. So here I'm showing planet density as a function of planet radius, and the solar system planets are shown on this plot. So you can see the terrestrial planets over here at higher densities. Uranus and Neptune are here with lower densities. But if you remember, the sizes of most of the Kepler planets are between these, and we do not yet know their densities. Well, here they are. Planets with masses from radial velocities are in gray, and those with masses from transit timing variations are shown in gold. And already by eye, you can see a feature emerging in this plot, which is that there's a peak at about 1.5 Earth radii in planet density, where planets that are, Kepler 10b actually happens to be right at about this peak in the density radius diagram. We can see that for planets that are larger than 1.5 Earth radii, the density decreases with increasing planet radius. which we interpret as an increasing volatile fraction in the planet. That's the only way to get its density to go down as the planet radius goes up.
So when you have densities higher than 10 grams per cubic centimeter, do you believe that?
I'm not showing error bars here.
Yeah.
That does lead to a question, basically, is there a density where you can measure it that would actually be really surprising or almost impossible?
I will get back to that question momentarily. That actually comes from interior equation of state laboratory experiments that people do. Okay, but let's look at the left side of this. So, right, we can see that there's a dearth of dense planets at smaller sizes. Oops, and this is because rock is actually slightly compressible. Right, if you actually go out and grab one of the pebbles on the beach here and try to squish it in your hand, nothing is going to happen. But under hundreds of gigapascals of pressure, rock is compressible. But not very compressible. So a linear Taylor expansion in density versus radius is apparently sufficient to describe the compressibility of rock.
Well, that doesn't describe, the data may be described by that. It does not describe that there are good models which give about a mass to the 3.4 smaller mass going as radius to 3.4 power for planets small between lunar size and Earth size, and 3.7 between Earth size.
We haven't measured the masses of any planets between lunar and Earth size.
I said theoretical models for uniform composition. So if you really get,
we have Mars.
Yeah, okay, that's true. The Mercury's iron rich. Anyway, there is much detailed equation of state modeling yet to be done for various compositions and iron silicate alloys of rocky materials. But in general, if we just look at the terrestrial planets that are not iron rich Mercury in our solar system, they happen to fall on this line in density radius space. Here they are, Mars, Venus, and Earth.
But Mars is...
And it just so happens that the Kepler exoplanets that are at about 1.5 Earth radii have densities that put them on this line. They didn't have to, but the blue squares here are the weighted mean densities in bins of half an Earth radius. So the Kepler exoplanets have densities that are consistent with this terrestrial rocky relationship.
But Mars cannot be fit with an Earth-like composition.
Mars?
To first order, I'm just trying to remember, because I'm just making sure I'm telling my students the right thing in my
class.
Like the difference between compressed and uncompressed density here is about 1, is that right? 1 gram per cc.
It's a little more.
A little more than 1 gram.
Close to almost 1.5.
Yeah, okay.
Interesting. Okay, but all these really interesting points aside, we've learned something now that we did not know before the Kepler mission about the general overview of the compositions of small planets, which is that planets that are larger than about 1.5 times the size of the Earth are typically not rocky, right? We can go back and see that. That's where that peak is in density versus radius. And then planet density starts decreasing after about 1.5 Earth radii due to the increasing admixture of volatiles. So if you see a planet in the habitable zone that's 1.8 Earth radii, the chances are it's not rocky. It's not where you want to look for some bacterium that's happily running around on a rocky surface. All right, to get back to, I guess, Jack and Mark's points about what we actually know about compressibility, what's really cool is that super Earth core conditions, including their crystal structure and equation of state, can be explored through laser compression experiments. So this is the Omega facility at the Laboratory for Laser Energetics at the University of Rochester. They've got these four huge beams that split into 92 lasers with which they ablate targets, and they can do things like inertial confinement fusion or just plain old compression experiments. So here's a paper that used some compression experiments of iron silicate alloys to explore the pressure and density structure that would be possible in Kepler-10b if it had these different iron silicate admixtures. So we can actually start to model and play around and try to match the densities of some of these slightly larger super Earth type exoplanets. Okay, so we now have accurate densities for about 100 small exoplanets, but that plot I showed you with Kepler's Hall has about 4,000 small exoplanet candidates. And a problem that we've had recently with those particular candidates is that uncertain host star sizes blurred the exoplanet sizes. The transit depth is only giving us the ratio of the planet radius to the stellar radius, which is why, of course, this conference theme is better stars, better planets. One aspect of that is we just need correct stellar sizes to get correct planet sizes, which could be really important when we want to start caring about things like the exact equation of state of a particular, you know, iron silicate alloy. Okay, so enter the California Kepler survey. This was a spectroscopic survey to get precise stellar and planetary properties for 2,025 planet candidates transiting 1,300 F, G, and K stars. So basically what we did is for a bunch of stars, we got these really high resolution spectra with the Keck telescope. And before, the uncertainties in stellar radii from the Keck were kind of like 35 or 40%. And after, the typical fractional uncertainty in the stellar radius was 10%. Okay, so what happened as a result of this survey? Well, before the survey, here was the distribution of planet radii from Kepler. So, as I said, there were more small planets than large planets, but we didn't see a whole lot of detail about what kinds of small planets there were. After our survey, there was a very clear bimodal distribution in the sizes of small planets. Or I should say, rather than bimodal, there's a very clear gap or deficit at about 1.8 Earth radii. And we think that this deficit is related to two different compositions of planets. So if we take the density radius relationship that I just showed you from my prior work and line this up with the planet sizes, the peak in the density radius distribution corresponds to this gap in the planet size distribution. So what we think is going on is that, oops, the planets on the left side of this gap are the super-Earths, and the planets on the right side are a group that has volatile envelopes. So how could this happen? This is actually pretty easy to explain through just a single physical mechanism, where you can get differential envelope mass loss that produces the gap in planet sizes. So you start with your protoplanetary building blocks and make young planets that accrete some nebular gas. But in the presence of heat, either from photoevaporation or core-powered mass loss or any other heating mechanism, the PDV work you do will preferentially remove the envelopes on the lower mass cores. So then you get a population of super-Earths that are rocky and mini-Neptunes that have retained an envelope. Let's see, I'm going to skip that slide. Okay. Anyway, photoevaporation and core-powered mass loss are great, but we really have a tough time understanding what is the mechanism that's producing these two populations of small planets. We can look at the statistical ensemble of the Kepler exoplanets, but really a great laboratory for testing how such a process would work is multi-planet systems. And the reason for this is all the planets formed around the same star in the same protoplanetary disk, and they've been subject to the exact same history of photoevaporation or radioactive heating from spurious aluminum-26 creation from a supernova, or whatever your heating mechanism is. They all lived in the same system and were subject to the same conditions. So this is a really controlled laboratory for studying how planets form. So as a quick review, let's look at the architecture of the solar system. Right, we've got all of our planets have very low mutual inclinations and small eccentricities. We've got our terrestrial planets close to the star, and our gas giants beyond the snow line, and some Kuiper belt objects. So what kind of multi-planet systems have we found from Kepler? Well, Kepler 11 is a poster child. This is a very high multiplicity system. Here's the detrended photometry, and you can see many transits here, which are quite distinct from each other. So each distinct type of transit has a different colored dot, and there are six different transiting planets in total here. So here are their detrended fluxes as a function of transit phase. You can see those are all very different shape and depth transits. And this is an artist's impression that's almost correctly to scale. Can anyone guess what is the one thing that's not physically correct about this figure? Jack isn't allowed to answer.
The orbital sizes can't be right. I mean, they're really that close.
Actually, there might be two things.
You're seeing in projection. So.
Yeah.
You're seeing in projection, so that's conceivable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You might find a point in time where that's true. Exactly.
Yeah.
Background stars?
Yeah, so actually the phases of these planets, I believe, are correct. Like that Jack and the artist worked together to figure out a point in time where this triple transit was happening. And
but you wouldn't see the illumination is not correct.
That might be.
You would see them fully illuminated. The background one would be fully illuminated, and the foreground ones would be. But we're getting really good.
Okay. Well, the major artistic licenses are actually probably that the system is squished. But I guess the other way to think about it is the relative sizes of the stars, of the star and the planets, are not correct. So Jack showed me another figure that actually has the correct sizing. The planets are a lot smaller, but it's less visually interesting. So these transit depths actually correspond to smaller planets than what's shown here. For scale, right, Jupiter is about 1/10 of the stellar radius, and this guy here is maybe 1/10 of this stellar radius, but these planet sizes, right, these transit depths are less than a percent by quite a bit, like a 10th of a percent. So these are much smaller than Jupiter-sized planets.
Another point is the stars aren't actually yellow when you look at them.
Yeah, that's, and they may have spots.
Oh shoot, yeah, that's another thing they got wrong.
No, okay. I don't know where this came from, because ours is actually a picture of the active sun.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the planets are in law are correct relative sizes to one another, right? Mm. But they're enlarged by a factor of about 2.5 in linear dimension. And the three planets transiting are in the right spots to the extent we can't tell which side.
Right.
But
there's
the other three are moved much, much, much closer to the star than they were at that time.
Right, to fit them all in a figure.
And in this case, they are all in back, so you get them fully illuminated. In our case, we showed one or two about the transits, which is crescents.
Okay, so there's a lot more artistic license than I thought here. I guess the one thing that I noticed that bothers me is the planets are a little bit too big, but I still like that figure. Anyway, we know from their orbits that the Kepler 11 system would fit within the orbit of Venus if it were transplanted to our solar system. And actually the inner five planets all fit within the orbit of Mercury. So these planets are much closer to their star than ours are to our sun. This is a fun little laboratory here. So this is an orrery. Have you all seen this before? Yeah, okay, we can skip it. Lots of close and small planets. Okay, so returning to some science now. something that I've been working on for the past couple of years is using the California Kepler survey with our new precise stellar properties to re-examine Kepler's multi-planet systems. So after making some quality cuts, our survey included 909 transiting planets around 355 multi-planet systems. Jack?
Nowadays we have almost twice that many systems. I'm wondering how many you cut because of quality and how many weren't observed because either...
Yeah, it's mostly that they weren't observed. At the time that we proposed for this survey, my proposal titles were like 406 multi-planet systems. So part of it was that we, you know, like we made the catalog and then we went after those and got most of them. I think there were like, I don't know, like 10 or 20 that we just never observed, but we got the rest of them. And then, of course, there kept being new multi-planet system discoveries from the Kepler prime data that then never got folded into our survey. So these are based on the Mullally et al. Paper, I think, was like the last, or I guess those are the parameters we used. I'm not quite sure which catalog was the last one that we consulted for our multi-planet target list.
Have you looked at more recent catalogs and added in any that you happen to observe as part of the Bright Star sample that now are known to be MULTIPS?
So we included, anything that was a multi-planet system that was in the CKS sample, either the Bright Star sample or our special, like, depth-related multi-planet sample.
So even if it wasn't a multi in Mullally.
And then our cuts were based, our quality cuts were based on things like the effective temperature of the star, the surface gravity, the reported impact parameter of the planet, so that we could actually get a precise radius.
Yes.
So these were pretty insensitive to, I guess, which catalog was the one where the planet candidate was first reported. Right, these are stellar, primarily stellar and orbital properties. Okay. So at any rate, here are the California Kepler survey systems that have four or more transiting planets. Wait, stop looking at your phone. I made this awesome figure, and like, I plan to get a job with it. Okay. So I actually made this one day when I was bored, because I had a lot of non-detections and wanted to just like look at something pretty. So what I'm plotting here is each system is a row with the star on the left. Semi-major axis is increasing to the right. And in each system, the dot corresponds to a planet, and the planet sizes are given here. And the color corresponds to the effective temperature of the planet, which is here. Right? So we've got the hot planets close to their stars, the cooler ones further out. Let's zoom in a little bit to get a better rasterized image. So now that we can really look at this, I want to know, do you see any patterns here? And this is for the stars people. Planet people aren't allowed to answer.
Some with regular spacing and some with not, right? So is that what you're talking about? Like the, you can see like 21 and
69, for example. And they all have four planets.
Four or more. That was the selection effect, but that is true. That is a pattern.
They all...
Yeah.
In most of them.
That's fine.
Yeah, so okay. To go to Mark's point, yeah, so this system, right, the spacing of those planets is pretty regular.
In most systems, the bigger planets are further away, but not in all. Sometimes you have big, small, which is weird.
Yeah, that's right. The bigger planets do tend to be at longer orbital periods.
So like 00435 goes small, like smaller, smaller, big, down the middle, up, a bit down.
Oh, okay.
That
kind of
goes up and down and up and down. Just curious.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Any other patterns?
There's a hole. There's a gap. Well, you don't see any of the line there. You see very few systems, but it points to the left or your leftmost.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, there's sort of like, yeah. I think that's there because there was like one system that had a planet, or a couple of systems with a planet inside that line. But yeah, it's logarithmic spacing. So in principle, right, that gap will have to exist in a logarithmic space plot.
There's an outlier.
There's an outlier. Oh, you found an outlier.
Yeah.
Where is it?
It's kind of SOL, right?
Yeah, isn't that weird? I wonder what Kepler system that is.
Yeah. Typo.
It's Johannes Kepler system.
Yes, exactly. Great. So Mark identified one of the patterns. And sorry, what's your name?
Boris.
Identified another pattern. So here were the two patterns that I thought were the most interesting. So the planets that are in the same system often have, as Mark said, regular spaces, and also similar sizes. So I've highlighted some examples, including 2169. So not only do the planets have pretty regular spacing here, but they're all very similar in size, especially when you compare them to the diversity of sizes in this whole plot. Or you can look at this system up here, 1432, which have a very different spacing from what's in 2169, but it's regular. And again, the planet sizes here are quite different from those in this system, but they're regular. So once you know the size of one planet, that's a pretty good predictor of the additional planet sizes in one of these systems. Okay, so how can we quantify these patterns a little bit more carefully? Oh, I guess one more thing I want to say is we actually call this the peas in a pod pattern, because similar sizes and regular spacing is a mouthful, but they look like peas in a pod. Okay, so we can quantify this pattern by looking at the size ratio of adjacent planets. So for instance, what is the ratio of the size of this planet to that one? So what we have here is we've looked at all of the adjacent pairs in the CKS system. So that's not just the systems in the plot I showed, because that was only systems with four or more transiting planets. So this is pairs of planets, triples of planets, any multiplicity for every single unique pair of planets that are adjacent. We're plotting the size of the outer planet versus the size of the inner planet in that adjacent pair. This plot spans from about half the radius of Earth up to 16 times the radius of Earth. And across all of these size scales, we see this correlation between the sizes of adjacent planets. So is it possible that this pattern is some bias from Kepler, some detection bias, where we can only see down to a certain size and that's what creates the pattern? Okay, so to examine the role of detection bias in this pattern, we constructed a null hypothesis and tested it. So what's the null hypothesis? Well, the null hypothesis is that the planet size does not care about the size of its neighbor, that it's drawn at random from some distribution. So to mock up and test this hypothesis, we took each observed system with its stellar properties, including the stellar size, CVPP noise properties, etc., and the orbits of the planets. And the only thing that we changed in our trial is we changed the sizes of each of the planets. So for each planet, we drew the size of that planet at random from a distribution. So everything is preserved except the planet size. And then finally, to test the role of detection bias, only the detectable planets are counted. So if this planet, at its small size, long period, and given the stellar size and noise parameters, would not have been detected at a significance to meet our quality cuts, it was discarded from the bootstrap mocked system. So we did this bootstrap exercise for every single system and created a trial. So here is one example of a bootstrap trial. And again, I'm plotting the outer planet size versus the inner planet size for each pair. And you can see there's no correlation. And just to remind you, that is what we see astrophysically. So we repeated the bootstrap test 1,000 times, drawing for each planetary system 1,000 times. And here's the distribution of our bootstrap trials in terms of the Pearson R correlation and the p-value. And you can see that our bootstrap tests never came close to reproducing the strength and significance of the observed correlation. So this is how we rejected the null hypothesis and concluded that these similar sizes of planets that we see in the Kepler systems are an astrophysical pattern, that planet formation is doing something to produce these patterns.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Can you go back to the plots, not that one, the ones before?
Yeah.
So, yeah, so the that one goes down mm-hmm. a lot more to smaller sizes
yeah.
than the other one.
Right.
So they're the same input parameters,
yes.
and it's just like it knocked out.
Yeah, so here's why that happens. So the planets that are smaller than one Earth radius mm-hmm. are really hard to detect by Kepler. So they're only found around the stars that are the brightest and with the lowest CVPP noise. And as soon as you draw planets that are that size for the other stars, they don't meet the detectability criteria. So it's very hard to reproduce these in a bootstrap trial because there's so few stars around which those planets were detectable in the first place. So there are two ways to get around that issue. One of which is you just say, okay, for my correlation, I'm only going to look at planets that are above, say, one Earth radius. Because if you look at the bootstrap trial, that's kind of where our ability to mock up planets peters out. But even if you only look above one Earth radius, there's a really strong correlation here, oops, that's not reproduced in the bootstrap. So that's one thing that's going on. And then the other way to look at this is for these systems that have the really, really tiny planets, you know, instead of just throwing those out, you can use those systems to get information. You can say, well, gee, I found like four really small planets in this system. I might not be sensitive to planets of this size in other systems, but in this system, I would have detected a transiting planet that were larger. So for example, I think 2169, which is here, is one such system with really small planets. If there were a larger transiting planet, we would have seen it. Or if one of these planets had just happened to be larger, we would have detected it. That's not the problem. So the fact that all of those planets are tiny and the same size is still really meaningful.
Lauren, when you did your bootstrap, mm-hmm. did you put the input distribution of planetary sizes as the same as the observed distribution?
I tried a few different distributions.
Okay.
I tried the observed distribution, I tried a log normal distribution, and I tried a uniform distribution. The last one was kind of silly. But the both of the others, actually all of them, failed to reproduce the observed pattern. So if you have a different distribution that you want to try drawing from, you're welcome to do so. But I don't think that that's what's going to make or break this test.
I think it's a really difficult problem. Mm-hmm. And what you want to do, the best I could do would be to try and reproduce the observed, get whatever size distribution is necessary to reproduce the observed size distribution.
Oh, okay, in like a bootstrap sense. I don't know, I would try log normal. I guess one thing I didn't check was how the sort of the recovered size distribution in my trial compared to the injected. My guess would be that the smallest planets don't necessarily get recovered super well.
But there are published, you know, distributions
yeah.
that you can use to
uh-huh.
say, okay, this is roughly
yeah.
correct.
Right. I'm frankly not interested in doing that exercise. I will, you know, invite you guys to do it. I'm happy with having used the observed distribution and a log normal, which I think kind of should bracket whatever the real distribution of small planets is.
So if you want to go back to our solar system, I guess one of the things I find this is, again, very naively, I would have thought, is I would have thought, basically, pointing is having it three sizes, right? Like small, medium,
system.
And I kind of expect the terrestrial planets all to be kind of Earth-ish, and the Neptune's all to be Neptune-y, and the Jupiter's all to be Jupiter-y. So is that just a statement that these planets are kind of, because what I find surprising is there's nothing to them.
Right, exactly.
So is there similarity then, kind of a correspondence with the solar system? Is
that I actually think about it the opposite way. So let's see, I guess I'll just point out here, when you look at the solar system, as Baris pointed out, it's an outlier, it looks weird. That's for a couple of reasons, one of which is our terrestrial planets are at longer periods than the Kepler planets. There's not a whole lot we can do about that. But we can look at the size diversity here and see that the size diversity of our terrestrial planets is higher than the size diversity in these peas in a pod-like systems. And one question that keeps me up at night now is, well, why? Why do we have more size diversity in our terrestrial planets?
There's a selection bias. I mean, the detecting the four terrestrial planets in the solar system transiting would need a higher alignment of your inclination.
Yeah.
And maybe you just like
maybe
the
you're
Kepler
yeah.
ones you sent
maybe we're just missing some, but still, right? There's no room for other planets like between these guys. So sure, maybe there's a really little one here or a really little one here that we just don't detect, or something else, it's just not transiting.
But we
do not have four planets of the same size in our solar system. That's something we don't have.
So testing a bias you could do by asking the question in how many of the Kepler systems if you had planets further out. Like how strong is the bias in terms of inclination, and that you maybe don't find.
There's a whole cottage industry of people who do this. The problem is you need to know the inclination distribution of planets and multi-planet systems, which is not known. Actually, people have to guess that and try to forward model and reproduce this stuff, and that's. Frankly, I'm not that interested in doing this because you can maybe reproduce, these patterns, but you never really know if you have the right answer or have ruled out a whole class of other possibilities.
But I think it's just worth emphasizing that, I think this is maybe your point, that this is a very small subset, a very small minority of the planetary systems.
This is just the systems with four transiting planets.
Right.
These patterns are prevalent in all of the multi-planet
systems. Close-in planets themselves are actually, not every star has them.
Yes, mm-hmm. And they may have just something.
Rate is maybe a few percent.
They may have something for
of systems like these, the occurrence rate is more than a few percent.
But they may have like a different. 10, they may have a different formation mechanism in common, different from our solar system.
Which is what I'm getting to.
And so that's then a bias.
That is where we're going with this. Yeah. Well, no, it's not. It's not a bias. It's physics. You just said different formation mechanism.
The fact that you don't find something that looks like a solar system is a bias.
There is a bias. There's an Andromeda bias.
Yes,
right?
There is that
there's
one too.
Andromeda bias that we cannot correct for.
That's right.
Because we have to compare to systems that have a one Earth radius planet at 180.
Yeah.
Really sorry, that's one of those.
Right.
It seems like you're not saying that like there are no other systems like the solar system, but
no.
There are this special type of system that we have to try to explain.
Yes, but also this is, I guess maybe a point I haven't made clearly enough yet, is a huge number of systems have this kind of architecture, right? Kepler has found that these small planets of these intermediate sizes are super, super common, that these planets, quote, something like 50% of Sun-like stars have at least one planet between the size of Earth and Neptune within the orbit of Mercury. So it's not uncommon to have close-in planets, and it's not uncommon for them to have high multiplicities in these coplanar orientations. These are not oddballs.
It's
yeah, they're like in terms of occurrence, they're like of order, I don't know, like 10 or 20%.
That's what we got when we compared M-Dwarfs to G-type stars. We got about 10% for the Sun-like stars. Much higher for the M-Dwarfs, but it's different.
And maybe even higher, depending on in how many of the apparently single systems there's really, additional planets that are just barely not coplanar that you're missing. Okay.
Can I ask another question?
Yeah, sure.
Obviously, there's a lot of interest in this result.
Yes. It's science.
It's great. It's really cool. Is it possible that the size of the planet is correlated with the size of the star, but not necessarily with other planets in the
Yes, system? Good question. What I should have said is yes, no, good question. There we go. So here is the full range. I forgot to say these are ranked in order of stellar mass, with the higher mass stars at the top and the lower mass stars at the bottom. I've also tried ranking them by stellar metallicity and stellar radius. And if you just look by eye, sure, if you kind of squint, the planets up here are maybe a bit bigger than like the planets down here. But in any given sort of range of 10 similarly sized or similarly massed stars, there's a huge amount of diversity, right? So if we zoom in here again, the range here, I guess it's not a huge range, from like 0.84 to 1 solar mass, right? But you can see these guys are big, these are small, these are big, these are big, oh, these are small again. So the stellar mass, there might be a correlation, but the stellar mass is not a very good predictor of the planet sizes. The planet size itself is a much better predictor. So that's another question I have, is what is the overall physical mechanism? Is it something about the protoplanetary disk that's telling these planets how big they're supposed to be? So there's some cool physics here that we have yet to discover. So I guess I'll point out one last pattern, which is the next question you might ask is there a connection between the planet size and spacing? If this has something to do with how planets form from the disk, you might expect that. And just by eye, these big ones are a little further apart, and then the little ones seem to be a bit closer together. So to quantify this pattern, I looked at the size of each pair, the average size, as a function of the period ratio for the pair. And you can see this structure where the smallest planets, so the small planets are these ones are really close together, and then the larger planets have a greater diversity of spacings. There's a couple other interesting features to this plot, one of which is there are basically no planet pairs that have a period ratio smaller than 1.2. And a ratio of 1.2 is where Lagrange instability starts setting in. So what I think is happening is that if planets get closer than a period ratio of about 1.2, maybe they hit some sort of resonance overlap and enter a chaotic orbit that eventually goes unstable and one of those planets gets kicked or ejected or something. So that might be why we don't see planets in that region. Another thing is, to be a little more precise about our language here, well, sure, there could be a connection between planet size and spacing. In fact, there's a quantity called the mutual Hill radius that tries to gravitationally describe what that connection should be based on how planets accrete material. But what's puzzling, I'm actually not really showing this here, but I'll just tell you, is that the planets, the small planets, smaller than about one Earth radii, had typical mutual Hill radii of about 20, whereas the planets up here have mutual Hill radii of like 10. So what I'm saying is for these really small planets, it's not the mutual Hill radius that's setting their spacing. It seems more likely to be like this period boundary on the left side. And then I don't know why they don't like to be further apart. That's still a bit of a mystery to me.
How many of these are of these multi-planet systems are in orbital resonances?
Almost none. That's another, I guess that's a bonus slide. Maybe I should just jump there and show you. This is like so important, and people seem to have forgotten this, but this is, I think, one of the most important things we learned from the Kepler mission, is that Kepler multis are not preferentially in mean motion resonance. So this is from Fabricy et al. 2014. They're just taking the period ratios from adjacent planet pairs and plotting a histogram. So what you can see is there's this really broad distribution of period ratios, and the dotted lines, they've demarcated the first and some second order mean motion resonances. And what you can see is there's no huge excess of planets at those resonances. And sure, I'm sure your eyes are like drawn to the spikes and you're like, oh my God, there's a spike. But if I asked you to draw, you know, at random, a period ratio from this distribution, the odds of you drawing one from near resonance are actually quite low, because there are just so many more that are between the resonances. So this has actually been a really big problem in planet formation, because there are basically only three sort of broad categorical ways to explain this. One of which is that planets basically form in situ and just never cross the resonances and never get trapped there. Another is that they escape from mean motion resonance, or another is sort of a combination of pebble accretion, where material gets transported across these resonances but doesn't get trapped there, and then sort of assembles the planets in situ. Okay, where are we? Oh yeah, I wanted to actually talk about why this is cool for science. Okay.
Do you mind, can you restate what you just said? I was going to ask you to say that again on the previous slide that you just showed. Not the one you skipped to.
Okay.
That one? Yeah.
Okay.
You said, why is it that these are farther apart? I didn't quite.
Why? I guess one thing I'm sort of thinking is, why aren't these really small planets? We only find them in this very narrow range of period ratios between this wall at 1.2 and sort of like 2. And I actually did a little bit of bootstrap testing, just like, oh, what if they did have ratios of like here? And we would have been able to detect them if they were here. And this dot is the legend. That's not a real point. So there's nothing in like in this part of parameter space. So I'm wondering why that is. Why is
there
it
when you see small pairs of planets are very small.
They're always really close together, even though we could have detected them if they were further apart.
There are a few cases where we could have detected them further apart. Our detection bias.
I tested it for these guys. So I just kept them around the same stars and just asked, okay, if I just moved the outer planet to some farther period, could we have detected it? And the answer is generally like, yeah, we still had a lot of room to detect them to like out to, I think it was a ratio of like 8 or so. I was still finding that we could detect them.
But we have two issues here. One is the signal's noise, mm-hmm. and the other the fraction, the transit.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm not saying your bottom line conclusion is wrong. I'm just not totally convinced by it.
Okay.
Because there are these biases against it.
The planets all transit anyway. So literally the only thing I would be changing is what's the period of the outer planet, and would we be able to detect it still?
Could that be related to them having to be very
close it,
I, yeah, so I think I, what I get, what I'm saying is that there might be physics where if you've got a small planet and then the next, you know, you've got another small planet, that as Mark says, the sort of the natural explanation is, well, the next planet is very close in period space and is sufficiently coplanar that it also transits.
And if they're really far apart, then maybe they could be up or down, or they wouldn't form that way.
Because if they were forming that way commonly, we would have detected them here. So that's not something that we're seeing.
Are they preferentially at shorter orbital periods than the other ones?
Yes. Small ones.
Yeah, the smaller ones.
That's how you find them.
I think a lot of the small, really small ones are from these like high multiplicity systems with small planets? Maybe a little bit, but like not a whole lot.
What's the, can you remind us what's the AU?
Okay, let's, oh, oh, here's one AU.
0.3,
yeah, and 0.1 is here. Yeah. So they're maybe a little bit closer, but that doesn't seem to be a very dramatic difference between the populations. But these ones are like closer than these ones.
Yeah, the reason I ask is that I know the occurrence rate falls off in around 10 days and that sometimes people invoke something special.
Oh, like a magnetic temptation thing. Well, I mean, for instance, 0.1 AU is here. That's kind of like 10 days. And I don't know, this system straddles that and like nothing magical happened there, so.
But it would actually be, given the week about star rotation, it would be really surprising if there wasn't a hole in the middle of the accretion disks.
Yeah.
Because there does appear to be interstellar rotations.
Oh, yeah. I would certainly not disagree with a hole around these stars. But I wonder if there is a magical radius or whether it's sort of on a star-by-star basis, something that varies.
Yeah, there's a dynamic factor of four inflation.
Okay.
It's in the star, so that's completely reasonable, what you're saying. It's a kind of window.
Yeah.
There's no magic.
Yeah, there's no magical, like, magic number radius. Okay, so I want to conclude by thinking a little bit about what process in planet formation could be creating this pattern. So we've talked a little bit about some really interesting things that it probably isn't. But one thing that I've noticed, and we talked about briefly, is that this pattern is challenging the status quo of solar system planet formation. So in the solar system, we have a period of giant impacts. Why do we talk about giant impacts in the solar system? Well, we need them to make big terrestrial planets in situ. We also need them to explain Earth's moon, and also to explain the iron-rich core and the small size of Mercury. So these are the traditional evidence that has been used to invoke giant impacts as part of planet formation in the solar system. So why would this maybe not work for these peas in a pod systems? Well, giant impacts diversify planet sizes. So by giant impact, I mean something that's roughly an equal mass impact. So if you have a Mars-sized object and no impacts, it ends up a Mars-sized object. But if you take three equal mass impacts, starting with Mars-sized building blocks, so first you make an Earth-sized thing, and then a 2-Earth radius thing, and then a 4-Earth radius thing, you end up with, well, something much larger than what you started with. So because you're mass doubling, every single giant impact makes a really big difference.
Yeah,
so
you have to do this with masses, not radii.
I'm getting there, Jack. I'm getting there. I promise.
Mars is a tenth of an Earth mass.
Oh. Okay. Sorry, I just took the figure from Inamdar and Schlichting. I see your point that...
Okay, they goofed.
Sorry, no, I might have just said Mars mass because, I don't know, people talk about Mars mass bodies all the time, so I'm conflating two things. That is my bad. The point I want to make, though, is that every time you have one of these mass doubling things, you're changing the mass of that object relative to the other large bodies that are orbiting the star. So you tend to diversify the masses and probably also the planet radii. So because the peas in a pod planetary systems actually have such similar planet radii, I don't think they could have undergone giant impacts in the same way that we invoke giant impacts in our solar system. So maybe they had impacts, but they were gentler or they had like a rain of a lot of small bodies onto a few larger bodies. But this kind of mass doubling scenario tends to diversify planet sizes. And so that would have destroyed the peas in a pod pattern, but we observe the peas in a pod pattern. So I think we have to question whether giant impacts are actually happening in these systems. So one thing that I think looks like a promising Tabby, you're, like, your eyes are as big as planets.
I just realized that they still have dinosaurs.
Who has dinosaurs?
There are these planets that don't get wet.
Yeah.
Pretty awesome.
No, they don't have
dinosaurs. When they shut the Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Yeah, little things can get them. But they also don't have life, because these are kind of big hydrogen atmospheres.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry, you're talking about the Lake Covey bombardment.
Yeah. Very dark over here.
Jen has what looks like a burning question.
I did. So you mentioned, so I totally buy that this gives you a big diversity in masses, but does it actually give you a big diversity in radii? Because aren't that's many it. Things of many, like you can have many different masses have basically Jupiter radius all the way up to mm-hmm.
yeah.
things, right? So would you
right.
actually have seen it in
that's,
your sample?
Yeah, so that's a great question. In regard to the many different mass things all of the Jupiter radius, I would point out that almost all of the planets in my sample are between 1 and 4 times the radius of Earth, and that the mass radius relationship there is like more massive things tend to have sure. larger sizes. But there's not a one, like a super clean mass radius relationship. There's a lot of diversity in how much of an envelope different objects have. So I will readdress that point in just a moment. Okay. Do you guys want to hear what I think about oligarchic growth, or should we skip this? Yeah? Okay.
Well, how much more do you have?
Not much. I'm pretty close to the end. I've got like maybe 2 slides left, 3 slides. Okay. So maybe oligarchic growth has played a role in this pattern. Okay, so what is oligarchic growth? We have a planetesimal swarm, and then these oligarchs that have formed within that at somewhat regular, here I'll quote Lissauer and Stewart. So actually this was a paper that Jack co-authored before the discovery of the first exoplanet. So it's really a prediction. And he wrote, the self-limiting nature of runaway growth strongly implies that massive protoplanets form at regular intervals in semi-major axis. Wow, well that's great. And then a few years later, in a very similar paper, Kokuba and Ida wrote that protoplanets with the same order masses are the inevitable outcome of planetary accretion. What strong language in the early days of exoplanet discovery. But anyway, these two predictions qualitatively match what we are observing in these peas in a pod systems. So maybe the Kepler multis are some kind of aged oligarch that never underwent the later giant impact phase of our solar system. And there are some technical details with this, like oligarchic growth is typically only invoked to make sort of smaller planets and not like 2 Earth radius or 4 Earth radius planets. So those are details that need to get worked out, but this seems like a promising avenue. I like it when people make predictions that come true. Okay, so to further address this point and also, you know, what Jen was saying, radii and masses are not the same thing, and you really need to measure both to know the detailed interior composition of a planet. So I'm embarking on a major survey right now, which is to investigate what are the masses and densities of the planets in a large sample of multi-planet systems. So I was actually just awarded a NASA Keck KSMS program. We had 16 Keck nights over the next 4 semesters to investigate this. And I'm seeking sort of an equal amount of time from the University of Hawaii. We've been awarded 5 nights in 2019B, and I hope more are on the way, because it's going to take about 40 nights total to do this survey. So what is the survey in detail? So part of the reason for doing this is there are only 3 systems, multi-planet systems, where there are 3 sigma masses published for 2 or more planets in the system. And those are these ones, Kepler-10, that's KY72. This one was just published this year, KY-117. This one is Kepler-20, KY-70. So those 3 already have precise masses for two or more of the planets. We are going to measure precise masses for two or more planets for this sample of planets. And what's great is then we'll actually have a whole statistical sample of multi-planet systems with accurate and precise planet masses from which to test these general ideas about how does planet formation work in multi-planet systems. So we can test what we were just talking about. We can test photoevaporation, like that makes the Fulton gap.
I'm just confused by your legend because the circle size is the planet radius, but then you have also color distinction.
Yes. The color distinction is to let you know if it's above or below the bottom of the Fulton gap. So basically what that means is that red planets have a chance, a good chance of being rocky, and then blue planets are almost certainly not rocky.
If they're a small planet, do you not color any planets that you don't have masses of?
Right, so then black means that our predicted mass certainty for that planet is going to be less than 3 sigma precision.
Is that 3 sigma on Kepler 10c? Isn't there a lot of controversy there?
Yeah, that's another detail. So when I did this simulation of what we're going to get, I did not include, say, activity from the star. And really, one of the big problems with Kepler 10c is that the period of the planet is kind of too close to the stellar rotation period. And so there's just a lot of confusion between those signals.
And is there a better mass estimate? I mean, it's still two groups get two different masses.
So pretty much. One of Susanna Grain's students, Rajpal, did an analysis with Gaussian processes, and he found that the planet mass is closer to like 7 Earth masses, which is what Hi-Rez measured, and not 17, which is what HARPS measured.
Yeah, I mean, that would be more consistent with, it would be a more typical planet of its size and location.
Yeah, so a while ago I was publishing the Hi-Rez RV mass of this planet, and there was a big controversy because the HARPS team had published a paper calling this a mega Earth. It's like 2.3 times the radius of Earth, and they thought it was solid. And from our high-res RVs, we had a 3 sigma upper limit on the mass, and it was not going to be like a solid planet. So we published a paper to that effect. But what was confusing is the HARPS RVs, the HARPS North RVs, really did have a lot of variability at the period of the planet. But they only had 2 seasons of data. They weren't sampling very many orbital periods of the planet or rotations of the star. So we went around our conference call and took bets, like Jeopardy style, like what is the true mass of the planet? What do you think it is? And I think Jack like hit the nail on the head. I think you guessed like very close to 7. That is assuming we believe the Rajpal result as the ground truth. Anyway, planet masses are actually really hard to measure.
So what types of host stars
do this? Oh, thank you.
Similar,
so these are the effective temperatures of the stars. They all have spectroscopic stellar characterization from Hi-Rez. So we know the V-sin I of all of them. So we made cuts. They have to be cooler than the Kraft break. V-sin I of less than 5 kilometers per second, log G of more than 4.0.
So basically all G types except 1K, an early K.
Yeah.
And metallicities?
We don't have a cut on metallicity. I didn't look at what our distribution of metallicities is, but we did have a cut on stellar activity. So we required log RHK to be less than minus 4.8.
Do we know the rotation periods?
We have V sin I. We don't necessarily know the rotation periods.
Well, what about astrosismography for these things?
That's a good question. So their magnitudes are here. They tend to be pretty bright stars.
Yeah, they're seismology or defense stars.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so seismology was a single
digit symbols.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so
digits and stuff.
I don't know if they have seismology. The problem is, like, these are the brightest multi-planet systems. Mm-hmm. So if I wanted the overlap of a star with astroseismology and multiple planets, that's just not in the Kepler prime sample. Maybe with K2 or with TESS, there will be systems like that that emerge that could then eventually be added to the goal of our survey, which is to... Oh, yeah. So we actually excluded that one, and for good reason. That's my favorite system, I should say. Like, I like it more than the solar system, maybe. But we had to make one more cut, which is that we actually mocked up what mass precision we expect to get for each of these planets with 125 or fewer RVs of the system. And the problem with really, really tiny planets, like the Kepler 444 planets, is, so these are all like Mars-sized planets. And we would need, I think, of order like 4,000 Kekhyres RVs to distinguish a rocky interior from like a volatile rich envelope over an even tinier, rocky interior.
But you bring up a point, which is that it's metal, very metal poor, and it has small planets. So it would be very nice that when you get these masses out, mm-hmm. to see whether there's some correlation at the accessible mm-hmm. range of the mass range, mm-hmm. whether that there is a metallicity mass correlation.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be, I mean, that's been looked into in the past. There's quite a handful of small planets with measured masses. And as you probably know from Evan Sinikoff's thesis, there is actually a correlation between the core mass of the planet and the host star metallicity.
For larger planets?
No, for small planets. That was the result of Evan Sinikoff's thesis, which is probably not on the archive yet. Sub-Neptunes.
Okay, so maybe I haven't seen those papers.
Yeah, that's all still like very new, but that's the result. That was the result of like the K2 key project, is that there does seem to be a correlation. But what we're going to be able to look at, right, is for these planets that are around the same star, right, like, you know, do these have really similar envelope fractions? And in systems where like the inner planet is smaller and the outer planet is larger, is that consistent with a history of photo evaporation, just removing the volatile envelope of that one, but this one surviving because it's a little bit further out? Or in systems like this, this one's super weird. There's a bigger one on the inside and a smaller planet on the outside. So we can actually test photo evaporation really well in that system, because if this smaller planet is close enough in that it could have been photo evaporated, but then this other one would have to be massive enough to retain its envelope. So we would expect to see mass diversity in that system. So
that's an interesting looking system, because those guys look awfully close.
We have to move to 23.
Okay.
I saw KPF. So are these with the survey being done with the new instrument? What's the story?
This is being done with Hi-Res.
Okay.
Yeah. Eventually, my original plan was actually to do it on KPF, but then I decided I don't want to get old and die before I do science. So I'm doing it on Hi-Res. Okay.
I saw it there. I was encouraged. Maybe it's a lot farther along than I thought.
No, that's probably just something I haven't removed from a slide. Sorry.
So, given that a lot of people maybe are leaving with an empty stomach now, I would say we thank Lauren.
Thank you.